Chapter 29. The shabby appearance of the Oregon was expertly applied camouflage to make her look neglected, but the dilapidation of the Gulf of Sidra was the real thing. For 20 years, she'd tracked back and forth across the Mediterranean, carrying her loads of oil, while her owners eked every penny of profit they could. If something broke, it was replaced with a used part, hastily repaired with duct tape and baling wire, or discarded altogether. When her sewage treatment plant went down, it was bypassed and repiped to dump directly into the sea. Her air conditioning system merely moved hot air around the superstructure rather than cooling it. And with the galley's walk-in cooler not working, the chefs had to balance taking food out of the freezer and letting it thaw but not spoil. Her black hull was streaked with rust while bare metal showed on her superstructure, and her single funnel was so streaked with exhaust that it was impossible to tell it had once been painted green and yellow. The only modern piece of equipment aboard her was the new escape pod hanging over her stern, put there at the insistence of her captain once he learned where they were sailing. With a beam of 120 feet and the length of 3 football fields, the Gulf of Sidra was a huge ship, though small in comparison to the 350,000-ton tanker that had been berthed at the Petromax terminal. Her outdated design left her 7 holds capable of carrying only 104,000 tons of crude. Though she had become a fixture lying at anchor outside the Mauritanian port of Nouakchott, a hazy silhouette against the western horizon that had been there for weeks, her departure went largely ignored. She'd steamed from the city as soon as Daniel Singer had arrived from Angola and had put more than 200 miles between herself and the coast. She was chasing a tropical depression moving across the Atlantic that had the potential to build into a hurricane. It was the storm Singer had been waiting for, the perfect conditions to test what the world's brightest meteorological minds and the most sophisticated computer models said would happen. With the temperature in his cabin hovering above 100 degrees, Singer had taken to spending as much time as he could on the wing bridge, where at least the ship's 17-knot speed created a breeze. He'd just gotten word over the BBC wireless service that Samuel Macambo's attack had been foiled by Angolan troops. Nearly 100 guerrillas had been killed in the swift counterattack and 400 captured. Singer wondered briefly if Colonel Abala, the only rebel who could identify him, was among the living or the dead, and decided it didn't matter. If he was linked to the assault, the publicity of a court appearance would only spread the word. He'd hire the flashiest lawyers he could find and get his case shifted to the World Court in The Hague. There he would use the opportunity to put humanity's treatment of the Earth on trial. What truly bothered him about the failed attack was that estimates put the amount of oil spilled at about 12,000 tons. Though an environmental catastrophe, it was far short of the million tons he'd been planning on. There would be no cloud of benzene arsenic acid lacing the storm and spreading its poison across the southeastern United States. It would be a punishing storm, the worst hurricane to hit America in recorded history, but without the noxious contamination, he feared it wouldn't touch off the panic he'd expected. He knew he would have to contact the media and explain once the storm was over. Or, better yet, when it was about to make landfall, how a chance battle in a remote part of the world had prevented a catastrophe. It would be one more example of how interconnected the Earth was, how we were leaving our future to the vagaries of chance. Adonis Cassadine, the ship's master, stepped out from the bridge. Unlike his handsome mythological namesake, Cassadine was a sour-looking man with an unshaven face and rodent-sharp eyes. His nose was askew from being poorly set after a break, so the smudged glasses he wore tilted off one of his cauliflower ears. "I just got a report from a container ship 100 miles in front of us." Sunset was still hours away, and already his breath smelled of the cheap gin he swilled. To his credit, however, he didn't slur his words, and his body only swayed a little. "They are encountering force 4 conditions with winds out of the northeast." "The storm is forming," Singer said, "and just where we need it to be. Not too far out that it has settled on its course, but not too close that it could fail to coalesce." "I can get you there," Cassadine said, "but I don't like it." "Here we go again." Singer was already angered over Macambo's failure. He didn't want to hear another complaint from this washed-up rummy. "This ship, she is old. Her hull is rotting, and what you have in her holds, it's too hot. It is weakening the metal." "And I showed you the engineer's reports that say the hull can take the thermal load."
"Bah."
Cassadine dismissed the statement with a wave. "Fancy men in suits who know nothing of the sea. You want to take us into a hurricane, and I say the ship will break in two when we hit force 6. Singer moved closer to the captain, using his superior height to intimidate the Greek. "Listen to me, you damned lush. I am paying you more money than you've seen in your lifetime, enough to keep you in a bottle for decades. For that, I expect you to do your job and stop bothering me with your predictions, your concerns, or your opinions. Do I make myself clear?"
"I am just saying
nothing," Singer roared.
"You are saying nothing. Now get out of my face before your breath makes me sick."
Singer kept glaring at Cassadine until the captain backed off, as he knew he would. Singer believed most alcoholics were weak, and this one was no different. He was so far gone he would do just about anything he was told in order to keep up a constant state of inebriation. He felt no qualms exploiting such weakness, just like he'd felt no qualms exploiting the naivete of Nina Visser's eco-crusaders or Samuel Macambo's greed. If that was what it took to make people stand up and notice the destruction they were doing to their planet, so be it. Hadn't Jeffrey Merrick exploited Singer's own genius to create their invention? Singer had done the lion's share of the work, while Merrick had taken the credit. All along, everyone believed Singer preferred to stay out of the limelight and in the background. What a load of junk. What person wouldn't like to receive the praise of their peers, the accolades, the awards? Singer had wanted all that, too, but it was as if the media only saw one half of Merrick Singer, the telegenic half, the half with the easy smile and the charming anecdotes. It wasn't Singer's fault that he froze at the lectern and looked like a cadaver on TV, or came across as an idiot savant in an interview. He'd been given no choice but a shadow existence. Only it was under Merrick's shadow he'd had to live. Again, he cursed that his former partner wasn't here, denying him the opportunity to lord it over him. He wanted to look Merrick in the eye and scream, "It's your fault. You let the polluters keep destroying the environment, and now you are going to see the consequences." He spat over the Gulf of Sidra's side, watching his saliva fall until it became part of the ocean, a drop in the biggest bucket in the world. Singer had been like that once, a small piece of something so much larger than himself it was impossible to believe he could make a difference.
he would be insignificant no longer.
Cabrillo's first order when he returned to the Oregon was to send her charging northward to where Africa bulged into the Atlantic and where the hot winds blowing off the Sahara eventually evaporated enough water to spawn hurricanes. He didn't return to his cabin until he'd overseen the refitting of his ship. The Liberty's hull was scrubbed and her tanks refueled, and she was back on her davit. The two submersibles had had their coating of oil scoured off with solvents and brooms, their batteries recharged, and all the equipment that had been removed put back. The Gatlings, 40mm and 30 calibers, had all been checked over, their barrels and receivers cleaned and their ammo bins refilled. Armorers were repacking the AK-47s given to Moses' men and tagging the almost 500 guns they had taken back from Macombo's forces. Juan hadn't forgotten the bounty Lang Overholt had put on those weapons' return. But as busy as he'd been, he couldn't come close to the work Dr. Julia Huxley and her team were performing in medical. They had 23 patients to look after, a total of 31 bullets to remove, and enough organs and limbs to put back together, it seemed she'd never leave surgery. The instant she stripped off one pair of bloody rubber gloves, an orderly snapped on a fresh pair for her to tackle the next injured man. At one point, her anesthesiologist quipped he'd passed more gas than a judge at a chili contest. But after 15 straight hours of work, she sewed closed a bullet graze on Mike Trono's shoulder, a wound he didn't even remember receiving, and knew there were no more. When Mike had hopped off the table, Julia had rolled onto it with a theatrical groan. "Come on, Hux," Mike teased. "Getting the injuries is a lot tougher than fixing them." She didn't open her eyes when she replied, "First of all, that little scratch you got doesn't even qualify as an injury. The cat I used to have clawed me worse than that. Second, if you don't appreciate my work, I'll be more than happy to pull the stitches and let you bleed a while longer." "What about your Hippocratic oath?" "I had my fingers crossed when I took it." He gave her a kiss on the cheek. "Sweet dreams, Doc. Thanks." No sooner had Mike left the OR than a shadow blocked the lights hanging over the table. Julia levered open her eyes to see the chairman looming over her. By the grim look on his face, she saw he knew. "I want to see her." Julia got off the table and led Cabrillo through to another part of the medical bay, a small, chilled room with a single table in the center. Four stainless steel drawers were built into one wall. Without saying anything, she slid open one of them to reveal a nude body enclosed in an opaque plastic bag. Juan tore the plastic covering the head and stepped back to study the pale gray face of Susan Dunleavy. "How'd she do it?" "It was a nasty way to die," Julia said, 10 times more exhausted now than she'd been a moment earlier. She stuck out her tongue as far as she could and let herself fall forward. Her chin slammed the deck and her teeth severed her tongue. She then rolled over and basically drowned in her own blood. "I can't imagine what it takes to fall like that and not try to stop it with your hands." She was cuffed. She could have turned her head at the last second. Julia looked at the body sadly. For all we know, maybe she did it again and again until she got her courage up for a final attempt. Cabrillo didn't say anything for a moment. He was remembering the boat chase in Sandwich Bay after he and Sloan had found Papa Heinrich murdered. The driver he'd been following had intentionally crashed his boat into the shore rather than risk capture. He had thought maybe it was out of fear, that he didn't want to face an African prison, but the truth was, the guy had sacrificed himself for the cause. Just like Susan Dunleavy.
No, he said with certainty. She did it right the first time. You've reviewed the security tapes from her cell? He turned to face her. Don't need to. I know the type. Fanatic. Yep. Biting off the tongue was an acceptable alternative to harakiri for captured Japanese soldiers during World War II. I'm sorry, Juan. Scuttlebutt around the ship is that she might have known some more useful information. She did. He looked at Julia. And I think Jeff Merrick knows it, too. I need you to wake him. Forget it. His blood pressure's still too low. I've barely checked his wound for fragments and am only now getting his infection under control. I admit his coma's much shallower, but his body's refusing to come around. Julia, I don't have a choice. Singer ordered the raid this morning at a specific time because he's got something else planned. He kidnapped Merrick because he wanted him to see what it was. When Linda interviewed Susan, she said that Singer spent a few hours at the Devil's Oasis talking with Merrick. I am willing to bet he spilled the whole thing then. Are you willing to bet his life? Yes, Juan said without hesitation. Whatever Singer's up to is likely to involve a hurricane. I think he's devised a way to shape them somehow. Do you need me to lay out what that means? You took leave to volunteer in New Orleans after Katrina. I was born there. We can stop another city from suffering the same fate. Julia, you have full autonomy over medical decisions on this ship, but only because I say you do. If you would prefer me to give you an order, I will. She hesitated, then said, I'll do it. Juan knew he should ask Linda to conduct the interview. It was her area of expertise, but he wasn't extracting information from a reluctant captive, only talking to a half-conscious victim. Let's go. Hux grabbed some supplies from the OR and led Cabrillo through to the recovery rooms. Where once Jeffrey Merrick had a room to himself, he now shared the space with three wounded Africans. His sunburned face was covered in gel to help his skin heal, but beneath it Juan could see the scientist remained pale. After checking his vital signs, Julia injected a stimulant into his IV drip. Merrick came around slowly. At first, his eyes remained closed, and the only sign of movement was his tongue attempting to lick his dry lips. Julia moistened them with a wet cloth. Then his eyes fluttered and opened. He looked from Julia to Juan and back to the doctor again, obviously disorientated. Dr. Merrick, my name is Juan Cabrillo. You're safe now. You were rescued from the people who kidnapped you and are now in the sick bay of my ship. Before Merrick could reply, Julia asked, How are you feeling?
Thirsty,
he rasped. She tipped a glass of water with a straw to his mouth and he took several grateful sips. How's your chest? He thought about his answer for a moment.
Numb.
You were shot, Juan told him.
I don't remember.
Susan Dunleavy shot you during the rescue.
She wasn't beat up,
Merrick said as a fragment of the memory came back.
I thought they had tortured her, but it was all faked with makeup.
Daniel Singer showed up one day when you were being held prisoner. Do you remember that?
I think so.
He did, and you two spoke.
Where's Susan now?
The scientist asked. She killed herself, Doctor. Merrick stared at him. She did that to prevent us from learning what Singer intends to do.
Oil rigs.
Merrick's voice was fading to a whisper as his body fought the drugs in an attempt to return to unconsciousness. That's right. He planned on attacking oil rigs off the coast of Angola and causing a huge slick. What else was he planning? Did he tell you?
You have to stop him. The oil is especially toxic.
His last words were slurred. We have, Juan said. His assault failed. The slick will be contained.
Ship,
he said dreamily. There was a ship at the terminal, but it wasn't attacked.
No. Singer has a ship.
What is he using it for?
It was Susan's discovery. She took it to him. I thought it was only a test, but she had already perfected it.
His eyes closed. Perfected what, Jeff? What did Susan perfect? Dr. Merrick!
An organic gel that turns water into pudding.
Why? Juan asked desperately, fearing Merrick was slipping away. What is it used for? Merrick said nothing for nearly 20 seconds.
Heat,
he finally whispered.
It gives off a lot of heat.
And there was the connection Cabrillo had been looking for. Hurricanes need heat, and Singer was going to give one a boost. If he released the contents of a vessel laden with Susan Dunleavy's gel into the ocean, probably at the epicenter of a forming storm, the heat would give the weather system a kickstart exactly when and where he wanted. That was how he knew when to attack the Petromax terminal. The prevailing winds would carry the oil vapors northward into the hurricane he had helped generate. Juan knew the seas off Africa's west coast was the logical place Singer would dump the gel, but the area was vast and there wasn't enough time to conduct a search. He had to narrow the parameters. What kind of ship is Singer using? A tanker was the most likely candidate, but Juan wouldn't lead the semi-conscious man with his suspicions. Merrick remained mute, his eyes closed and his lips slightly parted. Julia was watching his monitor, and Juan knew the look on her face. She didn't like what she was seeing. He shook Merrick's shoulder. Jeff, what kind of ship? Juan, Julia said in a warning tone. Merrick's head rolled to face him, but he couldn't open his eyes.
A tanker. He bought an oil tanker.
The monitor started to wail as his heart rate slowed dangerously. Julia pushed Juan aside, shouting, "He's crashing! Get the cart in here!" She threw aside the sheet covering his chest as one of her staff raced into the room with a portable defibrillator. Through it all, Merrick managed to open his eyes. They were clouded with pain. He reached out to clutch Cabrillo's hand, his mouth forming 3 words he didn't have the breath to say aloud. The chirping alarm turned into a continuous tone. Clear, Julia said, the paddles poised over Merrick's naked torso. Juan took his hand away so Julia could apply the electrical impulse to restart Merrick's heart. His body convulsed as the charge ran through him and the monitor showed a corresponding spike before returning to flatline. Epi. The orderly handed Julia a syringe full of epinephrine. The needle seemed impossibly long. She speared the area between 2 of Singer's ribs and loaded the drug directly into his heart. Up it to 200 joules.
Charging, 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 the orderly said, watching the machine.
Go! She applied the paddles again, and for a second time, Merrick's body jerked partially off the bed. The line on the monitor peaked again. Come on. Come on, Julia urged, and then the beat was back, widely spaced at first, but improving steadily.
Get a ventilator in here. She shot a scathing look at Cabrillo. Was it worth it? He met her gaze. We'll know when we find a tanker named the Gulf of Sidra.